comprises about 14 million bits of information.
A significant amount of that does have bearing upon the office of the ministry and the doctrine of the universal priesthood. What I will try to do this afternoon is to pull together that information as it bears upon my understanding of what you are concerned with at the workshop, both the office and the way in which it relates to the priesthood of all believers. To begin, it's necessary to have a bit of background, for what I will try to present is going to be organized in two different levels. At one level, I'll be talking about the responses of the Lutheran population generally. At the other level, I'll be talking about the responses or the information that we have based upon some typology derived from within the Lutheran population. The way we get to four typologies is to take the information that we got from almost 5,000 Lutherans and there find that there are two basic religious stances. There is possibly no more strongly supported conclusion in the field of research in religion than that there are two separate and distinct stances or modes, manners, in which persons hold to religious beliefs. Previous researchers have termed these two basic stances by a variety of names. The most recognized might be those of Gordon Allport, who termed them extrinsic and intrinsic religiosity, or Bernard Spilka, who termed them committed and consensual religiosity. We feel that what we have accomplished in study of generations is to go beyond previous research and allow for the identification of these two types of religious stances in terms of Lutheran theology, and see the two stances that are found throughout at least this population in this country, the concepts or constructs of Lutheran theology of law and gospel, that what has been termed extrinsic or consensual religiosity is what Lutheran theologians have for 450 years at least been asserting to be the kind of religion and the kind of religious experience and the kind of behavior that you expect where an individual's religious convictions are based upon the law and only the law. But on the other hand, what approaches the constructs of committed or intrinsic religiosity in our data can be not quite as clearly, but nevertheless powerfully suggested to be what we have understood to be the kind of religious stance, understanding, and behavior associated with also knowing or knowing the gospel and being oriented toward the freedom of Christ, the forgiveness and salvation, the acceptance and attraction that we find in the gospel of Jesus. With those two basic religious stances clearly delineated in our data as well, we then went beyond the material contained in the document that has become the book, A Study of Generations, and insofar as we had dimensions that were clear and measurable, that we could in fact locate persons along these dimensions, we arranged for a 2x2 table. For the dimension, chief dimension that we understood to represent a law orientation, and the chief dimension we understood to represent a gospel orientation. And this gives us now four different groups of people, the extremes of the distributions or the persons as they range themselves along dimensions of law and gospel orientation. So we have persons who are both, for example, high high in their understanding or orientation toward the law, and high in their understanding or orientation toward the gospel. And then you can see the various combinations. I have given names to these four typologies based upon my understanding of the dynamics of scriptural personalities and the way I perceive the religiosity or the religious faith and the behaviors of persons to correspond to those biblical personalities. So that this cell I term the elder brother typology. For I see resemblance here to the elder brother in the parable of the prodigal son. Faithful, dutiful, loyal, hardworking, industrious, prudent, loving the father, but not able to tolerate, or at least becoming angry and confused when confronted with grace. The low law, high gospel group of persons I understand under the name of Abraham. Like Abraham, seeing themselves as pilgrims in an alien land, yet very close to, aware of, and involved in God's continued presence and direction in their lives, faithful and loyal, yet also able to be open to the world around them and able to function adequately, remaining faithful within an alien and hostile culture. The low gospel, high law, I've given the name of Ishmael. For like Ishmael, these are very angry people. And the scripture describes Ishmael as a wild man against whom every man's hand was set, and against every man his hand was set. So this group tends to be individuals who are most feeling betrayed by the demands of the law, most convinced that they've tried hard to live up to the law, and it hasn't delivered. It hasn't done what it's supposed to do, that is, given them a good life, a way to live, and consequently they're very angry. Like Ishmael, thought they had the inheritance, thought they had the promise, and suddenly find that it's taken away and they do no longer have it. And they're driven into the wilderness. Low on law, low on gospel, I term the Solomon typology. Like Solomon, wise in the ways of the world, but also like Solomon, basically able to view people as replaceable, so Solomon could build his temple with slaves and his defenses for the nation with slaves, could maintain the significant number of wives and concubines that he did, which, by the way, makes the king of Siam's harem look like tea for two. And for whom, at the conclusion of his reign, the people came to his successor saying, look, your father was very mean and very cruel. He did lots of bad things. Please don't put that heavy yoke upon us anymore. Solomon gets too good a press among us. So that like Solomon, the persons low in law, low in gospel, tend to be relatively sophisticated, wise in the ways of the world, apparently open to change, but able to exploit other people without a great deal of conscience pain. All right, those are the four typologies that I'll be dealing with, as well as the general population. You need to bear that in mind as we now attempt to look at what the study of generations data may say about the office of the ministry and the universal priesthood. First, the office. We have an item in the study of generations that reads as follows. Pastors have the right and the power to forgive sins and to excommunicate the unrepentant sinner. There were five responses that people could elect. The first response is, I strongly agree. Persons who disbelieve this are not true to the Christian faith. A second response was, I agree, but exact agreement is not essential. Congregations need to be able to exercise a spiritual discipline and to have the power to exclude people whose behavior is grossly sinful and who do not repent. However, it is more important to emphasize the forgiveness of God through the absolution which the pastor pronounces. The third response possibility was, I agree in part. Pastors can only announce that God has forgiven sin. They don't really forgive sins themselves, and to claim to do so is presumptuous. As for excommunication, as far as excommunication is concerned, it doesn't seem to do any good and should not be practiced, even if it is a part of the Bible and has been a part of the church's history. The fourth response was, I disagree. I don't need anybody to tell me that I'm personally forgiven, and I don't think that pastors have any right or duty to interfere in people's lives. If somebody is doing something wrong, that's his business and not the pastor's. The pastor's job is to preach and teach, not to judge me or anybody else. The fifth response possibility was, I strongly disagree. The entire idea of anybody having magic powers, having priestly powers, to magically erase sin or pronounce a curse upon a person is a superstitious relic of a primitive age that has no place in our modern world. Those are the five response possibilities. First, among preachers, some 85% of the preachers agreed with the first response possibility. Some 13% with the second response, the remainder was scattered through the final three. So, by and large, overwhelmingly, pastors say, yes, I have the office. And part of that office is the right and power to forgive sins and to excommunicate the unrepentant sinner. Lay people, on the other hand, gave the following responses. 5% agreed with the first response category. 33% with the third response category, second response category. 42% with the third response, 7 with the fourth, and 10% with the fifth response. In very broad terms, that does indicate that at least in terms of the perception of the office, pastors and lay people tend to have somewhat disparate views. Now our four typologies. When we now ask, what about these groups? How do these groups respond to the conception of the office in part as expressed through the office of the keys? The strongest sentiment among laymen for pastors having the power to forgive sins and to excommunicate is found among the elder brother type, who tends to be the faithful, industrious, hardworking committee and board member whose support of the church tends to be solid, firm, and, while not necessarily liberal, at least stable. The kind of person whom, for the most part, appears to be the most active in many of our congregations, who is also happy, whose family life tends to be solid and secure, who isn't hurting too much, he's happy with his job, by and large, happy with his church, happy with his pastor, but does have difficulty tolerating grace and forgiveness. It's very hard for him to see that other people can be accepted. And it's from this group that you're going to get the greatest amount of support for the kind of view of the office that apparently most pastors hold. The Ishmael type tends to be overrepresented at the other end of the continuum of responses, the end that says, absolutely not, nobody has any priestly powers that magically forgive, and it's a superstitious relic of a previous primitive age. But to be, almost all Ishmaelite types are in the direction of the last three response categories. They really don't agree with the concept. It's interesting, too, that most likely, if you attempt to exercise any such discipline of this nature within the office, that these are the people you're most likely going to be working it with. If you're trying that tack, you're going to be putting it on the persons who are most resistant, most hostile, simply not willing to accept that you have any business even being concerned with what their lives are, which may account for the relative fruitlessness, at least at a human level, of many of our efforts at spiritual discipline within a congregation. The Solomon typology tends to be overrepresented in the middle and slightly toward the end that we understand to be a scientific humanistic end of denying any kind of supernatural or transcendent experience whatsoever. So they're willing to let you play your game and willing to let you do approximately the kinds of things that you may be doing now, are not likely to get terribly flustered or terribly fussed if you begin to make noises about discipline, but generally will not pay much attention to it. The Abraham typology tends to be overrepresented, and very powerfully so, at the second response level, which reads as follows. I agree, pastors have the right to forgive sins and to excommunicate, but exact agreement is not essential. Congregations need to have or be able to exercise a spiritual discipline and to have the power to exclude people whose behavior is grossly sinful and do not repent. However, it's more important to emphasize forgiveness through the absolution. Now, with the ways in which the four typologies break down in their view of the office, it becomes possibly significant and meaningful for you to understand your own experience as you exercise your office in terms of the different responses you get from people around these four typologies. Generally speaking, at first blush, it's likely that the greatest support, encouragement, and reinforcement for your efforts at ministry, so long as it's institutionally oriented, and so long as it's aimed at maintenance of the institution, is going to come from the elder brother typology. They'll be very happy, so long as what you do helps to maintain the church, the institution, the congregation, the kind of life which they establish or feel to be the Christian life. However, on the basis of our data, I would judge that at any point, or at many points at least, where you might attempt to probe deeper in your ministry and your exercise of your office to somewhat less than external or superficial or simplified statements of the Christian faith and life, you're liable to find the elder brother types becoming a little bit uncomfortable and not knowing or not being able to deal very well with your efforts to express, let's say, the emotion or the feeling attendant upon knowing the gospel, or to deal with some ways in which the gospel would lead you to be accepting and open, for instance, to leave your church doors open. That could be a real problem for elder brother typologies. After all, they're going to come in and steal the candlesticks. So we put chains in front of the door with signs, "Don't trespass," or "Keep out." Whereas if you have something very important and meaningful to you about a simple thing like keeping the doors of your church open, you're liable to find most support to you coming from the Abraham typology, who may not be quite as involved with the institutional stuff, but more responsive when you begin to deal with more internalized, let's say more spiritual or more flexible expressions of the office of the ministry. For there is a difference also in the way in which these groups derive their identification of themselves as Christians. We had a series of questions that asked people, very simply, how important is your prayer life to you? How important is your baptism? How important is communion, the sacrament of the altar? How important is your faith? Most Lutherans tend to say, well, all of these things are sort of important to me. Only about 15% will respond on the side of indicating that these aspects of the Christian life are not really important to them at all. Differences, however, are significant. It's the elder brother typology that overwhelmingly will say, what is most important to me is baptism, communion, and prayer life. And somehow, for some strange reason, de-emphasizes or sees less importance in their faith. On the other hand, the Solomon typology does not say to the extent or the level of the elder brother type that baptism, communion, and prayer are very important to them, but significantly greater or more frequently than the elder brother type will say, my faith is very important to me. I understand this to mean that the elder brother typology tends to gain his identification as a Christian in many ways from that which is external to him, that which is somehow outside of him, which admittedly includes the sacraments. Nevertheless, they have some more external quality. Whereas the Abraham typology tends to be much more internalized and to feel that their faith is what is most significant. Incidentally, it was somewhat of a surprise to me, it may not be to you, but somewhat of a surprise to discover that in the Lutheran population as a whole, a significantly larger proportion view their baptism as very important than view communion as very important. I'm not sure what that means, but it does say that when it comes to sense of identification as a Christian, the majority of our Lutherans look more to their baptism than to their participation in the sacrament of communion. With that difference in identification or source of identification, then, bearing upon the office of the ministry, I'd like to turn to another question we ask that has bearing upon the office of the ministry. Really, we're trying to get to people's conception of God. And so we worked up a system of, or a number of items that try to express this view. that two of the more important dimensions of people's understanding or their view of God would be along the continuum of whether God is immanent or transcendent, and whether God is personal or impersonal. To try to get at that, we ask this question. A congregation has no pastor, and a choice must be made by the members as to which of four pastors is to be called to fill the vacancy. Which of these is most Christ-like? And then follow descriptions of four kinds of pastors. An immanent personal one, a transcendent personal one, an immanent impersonal one, and a transcendent impersonal one. See if you can figure out which is which. One pastor is described as follows. A pastor is known to be a man who can administer the programs and affairs of a congregation very well. He is rather cold, and he is a rather cold and distant man who preaches lofty but beautifully phrased sermons, but does not mix very much with members. Another pastor is involved with people in the whole community and the congregation. His sermons stress active work for personal and social improvement. When people talk to him about deep personal concerns, he tries hard, but is not able to understand them. And his advice does not help very much. He does get a lot done, though. Another pastor is not involved in civic affairs, but commits himself deeply to his congregation. He calls on members individually. He talks to them easily, understands and remembers everybody's name. He is not the world's greatest preacher, but he tells people what they are doing wrong, and he talks about love and forgiveness. The last pastor is a very gracious man who sends a card to all the members on their birthdays. He seldom calls in their homes, but he organizes programs well and is a good speaker. His sermons are thoughtful and well worked out, dealing largely with personal problems that people have in their daily lives. By what model of the office do people tend to prefer? By and large, in the population generally, the model of pastor that is felt to be most Christ-like is the third response, the imminent and personal model of a man filling the office. Okay, that's overwhelmingly the choice of the population as a whole. Now, our four typologies. Can you predict which model the Ishmaelites would prefer? What do you think? Transcendent, impersonal. Right. That's where the Ishmaelites come up. A pastor who is distant, far away. Even as in their family life, they tend to say, yes, my father is the most influential person in my life, but I keep him at a distance. He's most important to me, but I want him far away from me. Strange, but that's the way it is. The Solomon typology prefers the transcendent personal. Curious combination. Like to have him involved in civic affairs, socially active, but not concerned with personal lives. And among the typologies, it's also the elder brother slightly tends to be in this transcendent personal. Not so much, and it's maybe not significant. But elder brother and Abraham are the ones who most powerfully see the pastor as most Christ-like when he is imminent and personal. We also ask a question about what people would do if they find their pastor guilty of preaching false doctrine. You want to hear about that? This is the item. Assume that you and several others in your congregation feel that your pastor is not preaching the truth. Which of the following is the closest to what you think ought to be done in such a situation? This is one of a set of several items that were an attempt to get at people's understanding of the gospel as it fits in lives. So the four response categories represent what we conceptualize to be a democratic response to human problems, a humanistic response to human problems, a law-oriented response, and a gospel-oriented response. So this is a different set of different kind of item again. Most Lutherans elected what we considered to be a law-oriented response. That if the pastor is felt to be guilty of preaching false doctrine, most Lutherans say what they would feel would be the best thing to do in such a situation is to have representatives of the group go to the higher church officials and present their complaints to get advice and help in straightening out their pastor. The other response that attracted a considerable proportion of the people was the first one that we regarded as a humanistic response. Though you recognize that your pastor is teaching something different than what you have been taught in the past, you also understand that human knowledge has grown and developed, and that the teaching of the church must evolve to keep pace. Therefore, you try to calm down your fellow members and visit your pastor to explain what's happening in the congregation, and try to work out ways by which everybody can understand each other better and together serve the congregation. The Abraham typology is the only group, really, that significantly elected what we considered to be in this item the gospel response, and that is that they would see the pastor privately, try to show him from the Bible where error might be, and be ready to forgive him when he admits his errors. But not very many other people did. Okay, so far I've taken a number of items that deal with the office of the ministry, the person of the pastor, the function of the pastor, and have attempted to provide some insight into how the study of generations data may give meaning to that. Now let's move then to the universal priesthood and what our data may have to say regarding this. Unless you'd like to stop now for some questions.
You characterize the elder brother again. We're having trouble figuring out how he could be high in both law and gospel.
Right, the elder brother typology tends to, for example, in the gospel dimension, tends to feel that his relationship to God is very significant, tends to place high importance upon salvation and forgiveness, tends to make the orthodox creedal kinds of statements, tends to endorse statements about Jesus is my personal Savior, and so on. He also, however, endorses statements that show a high degree of rigidity, a high degree of resistance to change, a high need for absolutism. He will, more so than other groups, tend to endorse statements like the Lutheran Church is the true visible church. And from other statements we feel he's most likely saying it's the only true visible church. He will also endorse statements saying that God expects obedience, that if you are sincere in what you do or what you believe and do, then it's okay. He will also endorse statements saying that it doesn't matter really what you believe, as long as you are sincere about it. He'll say all religions are the same, they all get to the same place. He will say, if I do right and love my neighbor, then I'm okay. He will say, loving your neighbor is absolutely essential for salvation. He will say, doing good for your neighbor is absolutely essential for salvation, and so on. So you get this curious combination of the kind of orthodox creedal statements, the kind of statements that reflect a cognitive awareness of, let's say, forgiveness, salvation, and mercy, along with statements that reflect basically works righteousness and the practical atheism of the 17th century Lutheran theologians, as they described it. The Abraham typology, on the other hand, will make the orthodox creedal statements, will assert the emotional content of feeling forgiven, but does not endorse the statements of, you might say, legalism, works righteousness, practical atheism. That's the difference. And now, then, when it comes to the matter of the anger of the elder brother at expressions of grace, I feel this is evident when the elder brother typology demonstrates a high level of resistance and rejection and hostility towards people who are different, towards a daughter who marries a Lutheran daughter who marries a Roman Catholic. You know, she's betrayed us. We disown her. We don't like her anymore. It'll take 5 years before we let her darken our door again. Or the inability to understand grace as it might reflect on minority groups, or people who have moral problems in their lives, people who are guilty of getting drunk occasionally, fighting now and then. The elder brother typology tends to say, you're a bad guy. Go away and don't cross my fortress door. That's where I get the sense of not being able to understand what grace might mean at a human level, as the elder brother did. Does that help? If we treated the pastor separately, we could arbitrarily divide them into four groups the same way we did the lay population. However, when we now look at norms and then compare pastors to the norms of these groups and how they function, by and large, the vast majority of preachers in the three major synods tended to be here. Not all, but most. On the basis of the data, I can't respond to any question about changes across time. Our data is cross-sectional. It's like a camera shot. And if I'm going to be faithful to the data, I really can't say much about trends, either in the past or the future. However, I can, on the basis of theory, make certain kind of assertions and say, if you really want to find out, then we'd have to do this again in 3 years or 5 years. And on the basis of theory, I would say, I don't expect there to be much change in these proportions. I am gratified and thankful to God that preaching has an effect, that when we look at now simply gospel orientation as opposed to law orientation, we feel we can assert with reasonable certainty that well toward 60% of the population has an understanding of the gospel. I think that's very good. I think it's most encouraging if we really bear in mind that preaching has the problem of dealing with unbelief, that the religion of the law, of works righteousness, is the natural religion of man. I think it's very good that and rewarding. It doesn't seem to me to be discouraging. Also the fact that in the study, very clearly, even for many who tend to be oriented towards the law, Christ is a central figure that Lutherans, on the whole, hold tightly to the figure of Christ. And the Christological emphasis of our theology and our preaching, I think, does show in that. Even for the person who perceives Christ as a new lawgiver, as a second Moses, still somehow the figure of Christ is extremely central, extremely potent and powerful for him in his life. Shall we go on?
Not too pertinent, but is there any way in which these different types relate to age groupings? Young, high school youth, young adults, successful in business, and things like that.
There is a relationship to age, but age is not a crucial variable. And while the tendencies are in these typologies and the kinds of persons that came out after we made the selections that we did, or the statistical cuts that we did, do show some slight age tendencies. However, by and large, bear in mind that one of the major things that our study suggests or supports is the contention that age is not a significant variable. And in at least psychology at the present time, not in sociology, but in psychology, we're beginning to say, look, age is a proxy variable. Age by itself doesn't stand for anything. That what age is proxy for is cognitive belief and value system. But with that in mind, yes, there's a slight tendency, and none of these are really powerfully significant statistically, but there's a tendency for the elder brothers to be older, and a tendency for the Solomon types to be younger. Ishmael's age has no, there's no effective age at all. No effective age of age in the Abraham typology, although Abraham typology tends to include slightly more women than you'd expect by chance. Any other questions?
Since you're in this, I was wondering if you made any distinction between those who were brought up in the Lutheran Church and those who entered the Lutheran Church as adults, and also perhaps a four-way division between inner city, urban, suburban, and rural.
Yeah, we got information on all of that, and we very exhaustively attempted to find out if those variables made any difference. They do not. All the people who responded also gave us information how long they've been in the Lutheran Church, whether they were adult confirmants or junior confirmants, which denomination they came from, and so on. And there's no difference in difference in our data along any dimension, a belief, activity, participation, piety, and so on, between persons who come into the Lutheran Church from the Mennonites, the Seventh-day Adventists, the Roman Catholics, Unitarianism, Judaism, whether they've been in it for 1 year, 10 years, and so on, and rural, urban, ethnic origin, income, social occupation, are not significant variables.
Was there any significant difference between Missouri Synod, ALC, and ALCA, and all of these?
Synodical differences account for about 2 to 5% of the variance on any given dimension. And that's not a great deal. It's not very powerful. There is much greater variation, much greater distinction, difference within synods than across synods. There are some emphases, however. It is clear that the LCA tends to contain a larger proportion of older people and older pastors who tend to have more of a works righteousness understanding of the faith. The Missouri Synod tends to contain a proportion of older members, again, who tend to, from our point of view, exaggerate the relationship between the visible church and the truth claim of the church. And the ALC tends The only place in all of this data, 14 million bits of it, the only place where the ALC is anything but in the middle is on a dimension of previous researchers that they termed ethicalism. And that is the basing of human actions or human ethical decisions upon humanistic ethics rather than upon Christian ethics. That's the only place where the ALC is anything else but in the middle, and in that particular dimension, the ALC tends slightly to show a higher proportion of people who, by the previous researcher's definition, we're not sure we buy that, but by that would show some what he called ethicalism. Otherwise, synodical differences are not really very important. And the ones that I've mentioned now are more a matter of emphasis and somewhat slightly higher proportion than anything statistically very meaningful.
One quick question or clarification on the high and high for the law and gospel. When you have the situation of a person that you say is high on gospel, high on law, are you saying that they're high on both at the same time? Or is it very frequently that you find that they are high on one? When they're high on either one or the other, but they're not high on both exactly at the same time. In other words, in one situation, the individual may be emphasize the gospel and de-emphasize the law. In another instance, he would emphasize the law and de-emphasize the gospel. Because for some of us, it's hard to conceive of a person being high on both precisely at the same moment. It would be more likely a henotheistic, you know, depending upon the situation.
In terms of theology, I'd have to say that what you're describing as a state of process or a state of flux between the poles of law and gospel is what I would understand us to be saying is true of all of us. That the best way to perceive us as Christians is to be in a state of dynamic tension between law and gospel. However, in terms of our data and handling it, what we did we have two distributions of persons along the two dimensions, and we simply cut off the tail at either extreme, 20% and 20%. So the top 20% and the bottom 20% on each distribution, and then made the combination. So that in terms of our data, yes, the elder brother typology are those persons out of the almost 5,000 who, on our assessment instrument, were in fact in the top 20% on both dimensions. Follow? The low are those who were in the bottom 20% on both dimensions simultaneously, and then the various crisscross. So in terms of our data, we say high, that's what we mean. In terms of the way it is for people, really, you're right. Okay. The universal priesthood, in terms of the outline given me of Dr. Hume's presentation, he began with the concept of meaning and identification of a Christian. I've already talked about that a little bit. To bear that in mind now, as we look at what the study of generations may say about the universal priesthood, there are a number of statements and a number of dimensions that have bearing upon this issue. First, in terms of a single item statement, you can tell exactly who is a real Christian. Now, what's your response? Would you say, yes, I agree, I strongly agree, I disagree, or I strongly disagree? That you can tell exactly and precisely who is a real Christian. Can you identify? In other words, is the universal priesthood identifiable in terms of people? Lutherans are about evenly divided here. A little bit over half say, yes, you can. A little bit less than half say, no, you can't. So when we think of the universal priesthood as it is felt by our people, one thing we have to deal with is the apparent tendency of a significant proportion to feel that that priesthood is clearly, externally identifiable, and that you can tell precisely and exactly who's a real Christian. In terms of our typologies, the group that most clearly and most strongly would support that statement that you can tell exactly who's a real Christian would be the elder brother typology, the group that disproportionately, more frequently than by chance, says, yes, you can. We had another single item that stated, and you may have some theological questions about this one, but the item was, the only person who can do good works in the sight of God is the Christian, because only the Christian has Christ living in him. Again, a statement which I think has something to do with identification of the universal priesthood. Here, the majority of Lutherans said, nope, not true. And a substantial minority said, yes, that is true. Only the Christian can do good works because only the Christian, only good works in the sight of God, because only the Christian has Christ living in him. Which group of our four typologies would you predict would be the most likely to endorse that particular item? Say, yes, that's true. Yeah. Abraham typology. Then we had a single item that read, again, in terms of the universal priesthood as it identifies each other and sort of reaches out and attempts to minister to each other. One of the things that is, according to Dr. Hume's outline, a part of the item is something of this nature, that everybody should be concerned with their own private welfare and stop butting in on other people's lives. Within the church, we should be concerned with our own private welfare and not butt in on persons' private lives. Here it is. What would you predict that our four typologies would respond there? Ishmael and elder brother said, yeah, that's right. In the church, we should be concerned with our own private welfare and not butt into other people's lives. Then we had an item regarding the relationship to the congregation, single item, that read something like, what the congregation asks me to do is not meaningful. The tasks that the congregation asks of me just don't seem to be meaningful at all. Ishmael and Solomon agree there. Say, yeah, what my congregation asks of me are not meaningful kinds of tasks or work. An item that read, the congregation where I am a member tries to meet the pressing personal problems of people like me. In other words, the sense of an individual within a congregation feeling that the congregation ministers to him, that expresses its priesthood toward him, and does something about where he is personally. In terms of our typologies, it was of this following. Solomon was the largest group or typology that said, no, the congregation makes no effort to meet my personal need. And the Ishmael, elder brother, and Abraham types were all at the same proportion, same level of saying the congregation does not meet my personal needs. And the Lutheran population on the whole is across all about 38% agreed with the statement that my congregation, or let's say disagreed with the statement, my congregation meets my personal needs. In other words, they're saying my congregation does not meet my personal needs. An item that read, "The Christian faith has little effect on the actual lives of most members of my congregation." Does the universal priesthood appear, even though they're saying you can tell who real Christians are, does it appear to have any reality in terms of people's perceptions of most persons in their congregation? Ishmael and Solomon typologies agree with that statement, the Christian faith has little effect on the actual lives of most members of my congregation. An item that expresses what might be seen as the popular, superficial view of the universal priesthood, and that is the statement that all Christians, not just pastors, share in the responsibility of witnessing for Christ to the world. It's sort of the popular statement of the universal priesthood. By and large, Lutherans endorse that. And here our typology has no effect. There's no significant difference between our four groups in terms of the response to that kind of statement, that all Christians share responsibility with the pastor for Christian witness to the world. And the level is about 85%. So you do have overwhelming endorsement within the population of that particular stance or attitude. However, as I understand the data, it seems to me the best way to view what's going on among the people is to see their function and their understanding of what we as theologians term the universal priesthood as something entirely different. I do not see in our data indication that the people have caught or understood or have any sense of what we mean when we talk about the universal priesthood, its relationship to the office of the ministry, and the responsibilities and nature of the universal priesthood. Our people, apparently, as I see the data, do not derive from that conception either their activity, their understanding, or their sense of being embedded in the congregation and in the church. What seems rather to be the case is that our Lutheran people have much more sense of belonging and being a part of their congregation and their church in terms of the model of family, not office. You may want to make some theological connections between office, the model of office, and essentially authority position and hierarchical position, with all that that means, and the concept of office as something to which one is called. But in terms of the psychology apparent, it seems to me the evidence we have says it's the family model that is much more potent and powerful in producing a sense of relationship to each other, to the pastor, to the congregation, to the community of saints, and to the world. For example, the way in which the data structured themselves and shaped themselves clearly indicates to us that Lutheran people on the whole do not make any psychological separation between their family life and their parish life. Their experience in their family life and their experience in their parish life are emotionally, psychologically, one whole piece.